Hello, and welcome back to Lower Decks, a Star Trek podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman, and I have Star Trek tattoos.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland, and I always hated Star Trek, but then I watched some, and some became a lot.
Yeah, and look at you now.
Look at me now.
Well, what we are doing today is Unification Part 1, which is the 7th episode of Season 5 of Star Trek The Next Generation, and this aired on the 4th of November in 1991.
This episode was written by Jerry Taylor from a story by Rick Berman and Michael Piller. It was directed by Les Landau.
So it has been more than a year, but we are back, and I am very excited about it. I'm really excited to be back. I should say that if you have just come to us because, hey, you love some Spock-Picard crossover, then welcome. Thanks for checking us out. And if, on the other hand, you are a longtime listener who is wondering, what's up with Discovery? Well, we are too, and we will talk about that in the next episode because we really want to dive right into this one. So this is an episode, both parts, I mean, Unification Part 1 and 2. This looms large in my memory of the early 90s, but not just because Spock is on screen with Picard and Data, though that is awesome, but because it really spoke to contemporary issues, things that seemed visceral to me at this time, the end of a Cold War, the reunification of a separated nation. Right? These were things that were in the news. They were part of a sense of general optimism and hope for the future now that, you know, the commies have been defeated. And of course, right, optimism, hope for the future. This is generally what TNG is all about. But this ends up being a bit jaded, certainly the second part, which at the time didn't maybe surprise me, but watching it again now really strikes me.
Yeah, and as my intro indicated, you know, I did not watch Trek growing up. I didn't have a coming into my personhood alongside Trek as I did with other things in my life. So I first watched this around 2013, 2014. Was probably the first time, that was when I was going through my first watch of TNG, that I would have seen these episodes. And, you know, for me, what was mostly on my mind is that I had traditionally thought of Trek as like a silly thing, which is like a silly, nerdy thing in space, which to be clear, I love silly, nerdy things in space. I was not aware, like no one had told me, nobody like sent me the memo, and I really wish they had, that there was so much substance to Star Trek. And this is one of those stories told on TNG that just makes it incredibly clear that this show is actually doing something in addition to being a silly show in space.
Yeah, and there is a lot going on in Unification that just maybe I don't want to say went over my head when I was an adolescent, but there was a lot of subtext that I missed and a lot of even just kind of context that I missed. I mean, I was aware that we were talking about Germany here, right? That this is about East and West Germany, but there were other things that that I didn't get, and I'm looking forward to talking about those. But really, before we get into any story at all, this episode actually opens with a title card that memorializes Gene Roddenberry, who had died just 10 days before this episode aired. And there are a few bars of the TOS theme over this, and I had forgotten this entirely. And so when I went to watch this, it really moved me. I was quite moved by this. And it really occurs to me that what we do here, Valerie, in talking about stories that other people have created for us, sometimes we're critical, even when we're praising, right? That what we are doing is critiquing someone else's work. And I do think we are praising most of the time, but we don't really ever just say thank you to the people who created these stories for us. And so this just seems like a good place to pause and say how grateful we are for the work of Gene Roddenberry and everyone else who's been involved in Star Trek.
Yeah, you know, and in this particular historical moment that we are living through, and maybe it's worth saying that we're recording in July of 2020, that it's really been on my mind how grateful I am for Trek and its utopic version of the future. And the CBS Instagram account has been putting up a lot of really, really wonderful videos from Trek cast members, old and new, in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. And one of those videos is by Jonathan Frakes. And it's delightful. It's always just delightful to get little tidbits of Trek information. And he mentions that he had to audition for the role of Riker 7 times, which, what? How come they just didn't give it immediately to him? Who else would be him? But anyway, he said that the last several of those auditions took place in Gene Roddenberry's office, and that Roddenberry really kind of just sat him down and gave him a talking to and was like, I need your buy-in on the version of the 24th century that we are trying to make here. And it is deeply important to me, and it needs to be, you know, deeply important to the actors. And that version of the 24th century includes that there is no sexism, there is no racism, there is no hunger, and there is no greed. Outside, obviously, of the Ferengi, but within the Federation anyway. And I am so thankful for that, right? That, of course, Star Trek has imperfections and things that we critique, and I think that we ought to do that, and that arguably makes the substance of the show better, to think about how it could be improved upon. But yeah, I was moved by that memorial title and just reminded, you know, there was a person with a vision here that is important to me and how I want to see the world.
And to me as well. This is why we're here. Star Trek is a force in the world. And even more important than that, I want Star Trek to be a force in the world. You know, we do a lot of speculative fiction podcasts here on the network. So we're quite engaged in what is up with science fiction and what is up with fantasy. And wow, I'm not surprising anyone or shocking anyone by saying that we, for about 15 years, have been in a pretty heavily dystopic bent for looking at our futures in our fiction. And I think it's more important now than ever that we have an example of an optimistic future like the 24th or the 23rd century, right? But that we have Gene Roddenberry's vision of what a good future for us could be like. Though, as I said at the top of the show, there's some pessimism here, actually, some skepticism about whether or not that optimistic future is available to everyone. We'll not actually get to that until we tackle part 2 of this next month, but that's going to be a fun conversation to have. But we are getting ahead of ourselves here. So really, right, what is the Enterprise up to this week is the question we always ask when we tune in to watch the show. But in this case, it doesn't really matter because the Enterprise has orders to stop whatever it is they actually are doing, because something urgent has come up. There is an admiral here on board the ship to brief Captain Picard. Spock is missing, except that he's not actually missing. He's on Romulus, and everybody knows this. But maybe he's defecting. Maybe he's a traitor. We don't know, but we've got to find out. So Spock is on TNG. This is a big deal. It's not the first TOS crossover, right? I mean, Bones was in the pilot, but this is still a big deal. And I remember this being a big deal that year. I mean, I had also just started high school. I still had a mullet as well, so there was a lot going on for me. But Spock looms large in my memory of that year, nonetheless.
Wow, I really wish you still had a mullet.
I wish I could.
I was immediately compelled to do some math once Spock was in the same episode as Picard, because my brain just kind of really could not handle the fact that these characters, that both Sarek, who will be in the episode later, and Spock could both be on TOS and TNG, and that this could somehow, like, this didn't involve time travel or something. And it just kind of was really, really blowing my mind. So I did some math that I hadn't done before that I would like to share. And maybe you hold all of this already in your mind, Glenn, but it feels important to me. So as we know, Vulcans live about 200 years. Sarek lives to be 203. We'll get to that in a moment. But the math that I did tells me that Spock was ages 35 to 39 when serving on the Enterprise on TOS. And that, I don't know what to do with that. Like, that is so young, right?
Yeah, it is so young. I have done this math in the past because, you know, Vulcans are not the only fictional species in speculative fiction literature to live longer than humans. But then I always wonder, like, yeah, why is there, then you always wonder, okay, so how long is their childhood? When is adolescence for them, right? What are the physiological life stages that they go through before they reach maturity? And it turns out that Vulcans map onto humans, basically, almost exactly for that. But then they just have a really super duper long adulthood, which always struck me as strange.
Well, especially because the math has also told me that Sarek was 65 when he had Spock, which I guess is possible also for humans. But it feels like, first of all, let's just say that, like, somebody being the first officer on the flagship of Starfleet at age 35 is just, like, already a feat, whether or not they are Vulcan. But I would think that if they were Vulcan, they're almost a little bit younger, you know? And it just totally kind of, I hadn't really realized that, oh yeah, Spock's in his 30s on TOS. And that makes him in his late 30s here when we meet him on TNG, because it's roughly exactly 100 years between the two shows. TOS started in 2265 and TNG was like 2364. Sorry, this episode takes place in 2368. But yeah, they're almost exactly 100 years apart.
Well, of course, Kirk also only in his 30s, but Kirk famously the youngest person in Starfleet history to make it to captain. And that was very much on Roddenberry's mind when they were definitely going to cast someone much older than that to be the captain of the Enterprise on Next Generation. There was a sense that they wanted someone with more maturity and wisdom and less brashness. And so, yeah, I mean, you've got the flagship, or maybe not, I don't know that, in fact, definitely not the TOS Enterprise was not the flagship of the Federation, but still, you know, a pretty serious business spaceship being run by two 30-year-olds. I mean, good thing that, you know, one of them is dispassionate by disposition.
Wait, Glenn, what do we call the Enterprise if it's not the flagship? They call it the flagship all the time.
Right. This is something we take for granted in TNG because they tell us all the time that this Enterprise is the flagship of the Federation. But this is one of these places where the Trek writers don't know what flagship means. Flag in a naval setting means admiral. A flag officer is someone who is an admiral. And so flagship means it's the ship in the fleet that has an admiral on it, that has the admiral of the fleet on it. But there's no admiral on the Enterprise. It's just Captain Picard. So it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And I think TOS actually was a little clearer on its naval terminology, its use of naval terminology, which makes sense because, of course, right, one of the big differences between TOS and TNG is that everyone working on TOS, the writers, maybe not every single person, but the majority of the creative people and also the actors and so on were veterans of the Second World War or the Korean War. They'd all had some kind of military service and were aware of it. That's just not true when we get to the 1980s.
Huh. The more you know. Also, counterpoint, there is an admiral on the Enterprise in this episode. You just introduced her.
Correct. Well, let's get back to that. So the question is, what is Spock up to? And it is going to be Picard's job to find out because, well, he's good at things, but also because he has a close relationship with Sarek, given the events of the third season episode entitled Sarek, in which they melded minds. So they're arriving at Vulcan now in order to talk to Sarek and his human wife, who's definitely not Amanda Grayson. And the deal is that Sarek is quite ill. In fact, he's dying. He's very old, as you just said, Valerie. And Picard now has to pump him for information. Also, we'll say that there is some business with a crashed Ferengi cargo ship that was originally made on Vulcan. Vulcan scientists are analyzing the debris, and since, hey, they're here on Vulcan, Riker is going to help out. That is going to be the B plot, and we will have to wonder how the two threads are going to come together. So there's a lot of exposition so far in this episode, a lot of work going into reminding the audience about the backstory. And really, all of this is coming just as a conversation between Picard and Riker in Picard's office, right? So maybe not the most visually exciting thing to be going on, but Patrick Stewart is just nailing all of this.
Oh my gosh. He's so good. He just acts around everyone in the room. And I think... really, if I'm going to say any one thing about this episode, what I desperately want to say is give me Patrick Stewart's jacket now. It's such a cool jacket. It's like a velvet bomber. It's just like, it is perfect. But, you know, I think it's probably worth, and maybe we'll do it more as we go on to talk about that Sarek episode with the mind meld, because that takes place during the Cardassian Wars, right? And I feel like the backdrop of Cardassia and Bajor is very thematically important to what's happening in Unification Parts 1 and 2. At least, I mean, early, you already said in this recording, right, that this is Berlin, this is Germany, and there's so much overlap in terms of World War II thematics over on Deep Space Nine and what we learned there. And we never really get too much about the Cardassian Wars. It's always referred to kind of backwards or on the side.
Yeah, that was one of the things that really jumped out to me watching the episode this time, because this is still a year and a half before Deep Space Nine. And there's some other places too. I will get to this in a little bit, where this episode is actually prefiguring a lot of things that have not actually happened on screen yet, but that will. And it's difficult for me to remember because, of course, right now I have seen it all, that they were just making this up and shaping the tone of what those things were going to be in the future.
I'm always amazed when writers do that. I know it's like simple, like, you know, writers think out major plot points in advance, but I'm always like, oh, they, how did they design so much intricacy so soon? Like, but, you know, you're the writer here, so maybe you tell me.
Well, but I think TV writing and TV writing of this era, maybe Trek specifically, is pretty well known for not thinking things through long term, because you're really just trying to get a story out this week, right? And it's about what is this story about? We're serving this story, and there's just no room to really make sure that what we're doing in this episode lines up with what's gone before, and certainly not about thinking about sort of laying down pavement, you know, for the road to future Star Trek spinoff shows, right? But there is quite a bit of that in this episode that we'll talk about as we get to. So the next scene, we are we're in the ready room, and Sarek's wife Perrin has beamed up to be briefed because Sarek himself is ill. He's too ill to come up to the ship. And so she's drinking mint tea with Picard. And I'm not saying that when you make the cocktail for this episode, which we're going to do at the end of the second part, I'm not saying that you have to make it a mint drink, Valerie, but you do have to serve it in this decorative glass holder that the replicator has made for this very special occasion.
Don't worry, I've already ordered some herbal concoctions from Vulcan that they claim are mint, but we now know from Perrin are actually just really not the same.
Yeah, she seems pretty upset about this. I am pretty sure that this glass thing that Picard is carrying, one for himself and one for her, I believe that those are votive candle holders that they got from Pier 1 Imports, because I think I had those in my bedroom as a teenager.
Funny that you should mention that, Glenn, because I've just fallen in love recently with a relatively new Instagram account called X Astris Suplex. And it just takes design elements from TNG, actually from all Trek. I think it includes also some TOS. And it finds out who the designer was and who made them and tells you a little bit about the history of like the pieces of glassware or furniture on the show. And it's really cool. I think there's another account called like Patrick Stewart number one, make it so, but so is SEW or something like that, that does this with the soft furnishings in Trek. And it's just really delightful. So I'll wait for the Pier 1 Imports post. Just, and I'll let you know.
Well, this is going to make it a lot easier the next time I want to redecorate. I can track all these things down. I mean, have to stake out one room of the house that can be my Trek room.
Wouldn't it be amazing if like the entire like Trek sets were just somebody walked into a Pier 1 and they're like, we'll take this section.
I mean, I think that absolutely is what happened. I mean, when we get to Romulus, which we will do eventually, we're going to see some more of this type of thing. But I'll save it till we get there, because we are here right now still to solve a mystery. What we learn in this conversation with Perrin is that there is no chance that Spock was abducted. He very clearly had put all his affairs in order before he disappeared. And he even disappeared without saying goodbye to Sarek. And here's where we get some more backstory. But this is backstory that is actually new, right? This is one of the things that I didn't ever notice before, because we've seen over the years, also, you know, totally out of order now that Discovery's in the mix, but we have seen how strained the relationship between Spock and Sarek has been. But in the TOS films, all of that seems repaired. Like, their relationship seems like it's on steady ground. It's on good. They're in good standing with each other in the TOS films. But now we are learning that in the intervening 87 years or so, once again, they've not been on speaking terms, and it is because they disagreed about whether the Federation should go to war against Cardassia, which, as you said earlier, Valerie, this is the war that becomes the whole backdrop to DS9. And none of this is spelled out for us, the dynamics here, right? Which of them, Spock or Sarek, was for the war and who was opposed to it. So I was wondering, Valerie, what you think Spock's position was here.
I was wondering the exact same thing, and I went to go try and look it up and didn't really find information, because this is basically what we get, is this information, which does not answer what I think is a pretty essential question. My assumption, based on what I know of Sarek, is that his position would be to stay out of things, and take the path of least resistance that preserves, standards of diplomacy and doesn't get involved. And from what I know of Spock and his morals and sense of justice, I would think he would be on the side of saying we have to get involved. That would be my guess.
Okay, so that's really interesting. I read this a little bit differently. One thing I will say is that Picard does use the phrase Spock's opposition here, which I guess could mean opposition to the war, but I think grammatically means Spock's opposition to Sarek, to Sarek's position. But my sense was that Spock is pro-peace. This is certainly what we see in Star Trek VI, which we're going to talk about later. And that is what this episode is about, too, right? This episode is about Spock engaging in cowboy diplomacy in order to bring an end to a Cold War, right? To bring peace, that he seems to be anti-war in the two incarnations of Spock that we are getting here in November and December of 1991. So my sense of it is that he was against the war because he has become an anti-war diplomat here. And I also was thinking of this then in terms of the Sarek that we see in Discovery, who, of course, you know, didn't really exist yet at the time that this script was written. But the Sarek that we see in Discovery seems to me much more militant than I have usually thought of Sarek as being. But then it occurred to me that maybe the writers of Discovery were really picking up on this Sarek here, this idea that Sarek is actually kind of a hawk.
Those are excellent counterpoints, and I think I could easily be convinced of your side of the argument or the conclusions that you are coming to from the same information. Part of the issue is that we don't really have a full set of information, right? We don't exactly know enough, to my knowledge, about the Cardassian Wars. So here's the premise that I am operating of, which might not be correct. The premise that I have in mind is that the Federation gets involved to help Bajor be liberated from Cardassia, that it's an anti-Cardassian colonization and an imperialism move, and that they're stepping in to help Bajor. And in that sense, if I read it that way, then I feel that Spock would easily be part of some sort of resistance movement, or like we should come to their aid movement. And that, to me, that still is in line with Spock being pro-peace. Right? That's ultimately what he wants, and he is not okay with the Cardassian occupation. And he will do whatever it takes to liberate Bajor or be part of that good fight. Whereas Sarek might take more hawkish tendencies of traditional military lines. And you're right, I'm also thinking of Discovery here, where we hear Sarek tell Michael that, you know, we fired first, but y'all can't do that because you're the Federation. But we could because we're Vulcans and blah, 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 blah. And it was a little bit confusing coming out of the mouth of a Vulcan to hear that he had chosen the path of violence first without provocation. So that's how I'm reading it. However, if we're just talking about like a war that isn't about, you know, liberating Bajor, my mind would easily change, I think.
Right. And well, so many things to do here. Let's talk about the Star Trek stuff first, because this is one of the things we don't really know what is the history of these wars. I think the first appearance of Cardassians is in season 4 of The Next Generation. We may get mention of the war there because we do learn that Chief O'Brien has fought in the war, but I don't remember exactly when he tells us that. It's possible that's even a little bit after this episode. But we just don't know a whole lot about Cardassia at this point. And then even when we get an entire show that is really about Cardassians that takes place on a Cardassian space station taken over by the Federation, we still don't ever get anything spelled out for us specifically about what was the impetus for the war between the Cardassian Union and the Federation. And I don't think you're wrong to think that it was to liberate Bajor. I mean, there's certainly, we do know for sure that the Federation does help liberate Bajor. I had always inferred that that was actually something that happened fairly late in the war. I mean, I guess we know it's literally just happening in the backdrop of Deep Space Nine. So in terms of when it actually happened during the war was definitely late, but that doesn't mean it wasn't the impetus for the war. But I always inferred that that was not the impetus for the war, that what actually caused the war was something else. And in fact, I guess I kind of always thought that the war was really aggressive on the part of Cardassia, that Cardassia was actually trying to conquer Federation territory, or at least encroaching on a Federation sphere of influence, maybe some planet, some civilization that was sort of a Federation protectorate, if we're thinking in Cold War terminology. But we don't ever actually know. So without being able to answer that question, we can't really know where to place Spock and Sarek here, even setting aside kind of our different maybe interpretations of their personalities, which is, I think, what we really need to talk about, because that's really the ethical conundrum that humanitarian statesmen get into, is to be opposed to war as an awful, brutal, destructive thing that is bad in itself, but then also it is the mechanism by which we can liberate people who are being persecuted, people who are going to be victims of a genocide or otherwise tyrannized or persecuted in some way. This is certainly my own military experience, not very long after this episode came out during the wars in the Balkans, when intervention to stop a genocide was what we were doing, ordered by a president who had dodged the Vietnam draft, right? So these are the types of ethical conundrums that you end up in when you have these types of positions. And it's really great here to see Star Trek pointing that out to us and making us try to figure this out.
And also the generational divide between father and son over the politics of war and going to war is something that, was never part of my experience, but is in the very not too distant past, right? And so even just this small detail in the minute or 30 seconds of this scene is rich with like people's real life stories. However, I think we do agree on their personality features, right? I think we're both saying we imagine Sarek to be more militaristic and we imagine Spock to be more on the side of peace. To me, the question is Spock achieving being on the side of peace by being a partisan fighter or by being anti-war?
Right, exactly. Yeah, I think probably the word that we're looking for Sarek is realpolitik, right? The Otto von Bismarck style of diplomacy and using military as diplomacy by other means, in which Sarek is hawkish, but part of his I think part of his worldview is to think about what is the price of a war. And if this is a question of should we go to war against the Cardassian Empire in order to liberate Bajor or not, someone with a realpolitik bent might say no because of what it will cost us, because it's risky in terms of the geopolitical maneuverings. It's risky in terms of potential lives lost. What if we don't actually win the war and that sort of thing? But I think in either case, right, we are thinking of Sarek as perhaps colder, as less emotional about this than Spock.
Which maps right on to, everything we know about both characters. One is 100% Vulcan and one is half human. And that is what they're always, that is the primary thing we know as the difference between these two people.
Right. Well, let's actually go meet Sarek in this episode now, because Perrin does not know what Spock is up to. She does agree to let Picard see Sarek. So Vulcan is next. I am skipping some B-plot here, by the way. We're going to return to that later. So we are at Sarek's house in Toronto, where Sarek is in bad shape. He's lying in bed. He's muttering to himself. There's a sort of Vulcan dementia, I guess, a Vulcan Alzheimer's that is killing him. And it manifests in a number of ways. One of them is that he can't control his emotions anymore. And we saw the onset, or the early stages anyway, of this in the episode Sarek. But he does become lucid enough here to talk to Picard, and he gives Picard a key piece of information. And this involves the Kittimer Conference, which ended the Cold War between the Klingons and the Federation in Star Trek VI, which happened, you know, 80-some years ago in-universe, but which had not actually happened yet in real time, because that movie doesn't come out for another month. So all of this was a setup to hype the release of that movie, and then vice versa as well. And I know that I saw this when it aired, and then definitely saw the film a little bit later. It was probably like 6 weeks later, because that's when the school, you know, holiday would have been. But I don't really think I noticed at the time that we didn't have any idea what Sarek was talking about when this aired.
It's so funny to watch these things backwards and to be incorporating all of, I don't even know if we're watching them backwards. I guess to a certain extent we are, but then also like when you throw Discovery in there, like, and Picard, like it just gets really confusing what's happening when and what we knew when. But I hadn't thought about that, the kind of the beats of that release, and that's really clever.
Yeah, it's really quite clever. And you know, Star Trek VI is one of my favorite films. I mean, it's one of most people's favorite films, and I've seen it a zillion times. I've seen it more than I have seen this episode, for sure. So this was kind of the first time that because I had looked up the date for when this aired and went, wait, hold on a second. Yeah, what did 14-year-old Glenn do when he was watching this episode and eating very terrible Domino's pizza on some Saturday night in November of 1991? Just didn't know what this reference was and just rolled with it, which is what everyone had to do, which I think is a lot of fun.
Well, I really wish I had known you then and could hang out like in this basement eating Domino's with you. I think that would have been absolutely delightful, though maybe our differing viewpoints and interests in the Trek world would have driven us apart in our teenage and adolescent immaturity, because it will come as no surprise to anyone that I find Star Trek VI rather dense, kind of hard to get through. And of course that I still absolutely favor Star Trek IV, the one with the whales. So like we have different viewpoints here. And I also wanted to mention that, the Vulcan Alzheimer's is Bendai syndrome, sometimes pronounced Bandi syndrome. But I think it's Perrin that says that. So maybe she's just really bad at Vulcan. But Bendai syndrome, yeah, it makes you not be able to control your emotions, right? Which is like, of course, every illness that strikes a Vulcan is somehow related to not being able to control your emotions, because that's like the thing we know about Vulcans. And that's how the mind meld with Jean-Luc Picard, who I keep wanting to call Patrick Stewart. I really just think of them as the same person.
We all do.
Rather than like an actor playing a role, they're really just the same person in my mind. That Sarek was able to project through the mind meld his emotions onto Picard, so then he could go about being diplomatic and not have to deal with you know, everything that he was unable to control. So just throwing that out there.
Yeah, we need to do that episode someday. Sarek is a really fantastic episode. And, you know, if you think of Alzheimer's and dementia as being diseases that attack who you are, right, that they make you unable to be yourself anymore. Well, that's the thing that goes to the core of Vulcans here is being distanced from their emotions. So it's a really great analogy. Yeah, this is a great episode. We're going to have to do that at some point. But here we are in this episode instead. So really here, Sarek thinks that Spock has gone to Romulus to hang out with someone that he met at the Kittimer Conference. This is a senator, a Romulan senator named Pardek. And no matter what, Sarek is indignant that no matter what, there is no chance that Spock is a traitor, right? He's not there to defect. And one of the things that's going on in this scene that I think is really so awesome, right, is that Sarek is suffering from this condition. And Mark Leonard has a lot to do here to convey this. But I found myself really drawn to Patrick Stewart's performance as someone who's in this really awkward conversation with a person who loses track of it, loses track of what you're talking about, and may also be really prone to anger. I was really watching his performance here, the way that he's responding to Mark Leonard.
Right. There is a beautiful moment in this scene where Sarek loses the thread of the conversation, where Sarek has introduced this character of Pardek, has just gotten through explaining to Picard who Pardek is, what Spock's relationship to Pardek is, all of this complicated, you know, diplomatic stuff. And then Picard responds, says something using the name Pardek, and Sarek loses the thread and asks something like, how do you know about Pardek? And the pause and then response that comes from Picard is absolutely amazing, especially because I have grandparents who have suffered dementia and Alzheimer's. And a lot of the conventional wisdom is that you kind of just go with what they're saying, right? You don't try to correct them and redirect them to the truth, but you try to just like be there and inhabit their world as it is present for them. So, and I think to me, because of my own personal experience with this and because of Patrick Stewart's acting and the writing, it was such an emotional moment where you see Picard think for a second and go, I'm not going to say you just told me who Pardek was, because he could have easily made that choice. Instead, he says, oh, I've heard of him, you know, like just playing into what Sarek is able to do in that moment. And I was really, really taken by it.
I was as well. And I think like you, this is the first time that I've really sat down with this episode since going through something similar with my own grandmother and having to be in the same position that Picard is in here. And I think that's why I was really drawn to that performance there, because it's clearly both written and acted by someone who's been in this position as well. And it's just a really subtle, but really great depiction of that experience. And I think this is an experience that is common to so many of us. And it was just really well done. It really made this scene believable, but it was also nice to see that represented on screen.
There was also just something so tender about, like, I don't know how Patrick Stewart does it other than by being perfect and amazing. but like, you just, the scene oozes with how much Picard cares about Sarek and how connected he really, really does feel to him after this mind meld.
Yeah, and this is a sad scene. Sarek doesn't actually die in this scene. He dies later in the episode, and we're going to be informed of his death. Like it's an off-camera death. We just get told about it later. But this is Mark Leonard's last scene as Sarek ever. And I love Mark Leonard. I love Mark Leonard in both roles that he played in Star Trek. But I love Mark Leonard as Sarek. And it's this, you know, I'm filled with sadness there as well that this is the last of his performance as Sarek that we get. The good news is, though, that I could just watch it over and over again. And hey, that's what we do here. So, well, let's leave Sarek now. And in the next scene, his hypothesis is going to be borne out. We're going to get visual confirmation that Pardek is definitely the dude that Spock was with in the photo of him on Romulus. And Data's going to give us some information about Pardek. Pardek has been a senator for 90 years, and he is regarded as a man of the people, as someone who has sponsored many reforms. But he is at the same time regarded by what Data calls Romulan leadership as a radical, because he always advocates peace. And of course, right, I think, Valerie, as you are expecting, I want to stop here and I want to write an entire article about the Romulan Constitution based on what we learned from Data. So I do want to pause and tease this out and especially think about it in terms of the Romulans as space Romans, right? There are two things that really jump out to me here as tensions, inconsistencies maybe, but let's just say tensions in what Data tells us. And the first is, in what way is being a senator not being part of Romulan leadership? Because I really feel like up to this point in Star Trek, I've always inferred that the Romulan Senate is the highest level of government, and that this idea is based loosely on the Roman Republic. But that doesn't seem to be the case here, right? Data seems to think of them as two distinct things.
I feel as if they've mixed... As you've already clearly stated that like they've lost track of their threads, or they're blending a couple things without thinking of them. Like they're starting from this idea of the Roman Senate, but then for a moment here, actually just think about the American Senate.
Right.
And there's like, well, they're both the Senate, so it's fine.
Right. That was the second thing that jumped out to me, right, is that Data tells us that Pardek represents a district, that being a senator means representing and advocating the interests of a geographic constituency, which is, you know, what it means for us in America, or what an MP would mean in other countries. But this is totally different from what it meant to be a senator in the Roman Republic, where it just meant that within the body of Roman citizens, you were a member of the highest economic class, that you were rich, you had a certain amount of wealth. It's not an elected position, though I guess it may not be on Romulus either. We don't hear anything about elections necessarily, but it also was not representative. The only interests you were representing were your own, or really your family's interests. But here we're told that maybe the Romulan Star Empire is some kind of representative democracy, and I'm kind of befuddled by that.
Yeah, you are entirely correct that I'm just going to go with they heard the word Senate and decided to just like use whatever came to mind in that moment for them, regardless of where it was from or what it was referring to. And I also, you know, I'm a little bit, it's really interesting, especially in a contemporary context, to hear there is this elected official who is considered a radical for being pro-peace, right? Considered a radical for being pro-human rights or whatever it is, Romulan rights. And to me, that just serves as a reminder of what life on Romulus is like, what the government is for, that they're like a warring and they're the baddies, right? Like, so to be pro-peace is to be radical, but that really struck me as a way of reminding us what Romulan society is like.
Yeah, and we are going to see some of those tensions when we actually get to Romulus. One thing we should say, because this probably is the first episode of Lower Decks for a lot of people. So people may not be aware that you and I are big classics nerds. We both have classics backgrounds. And hey, we met in a Latin class. So anytime there's any possibility to talk about Romans or Greeks, we're going to do it. And I guess one of the things that it was rubbing me the wrong way about some of this information is that I just so desperately want Romulans to be space Romans. I don't want them to be space Americans. I want them to be space Romans.
Right. But we know that Trek is not good at holding tightly onto the thread of whatever monoculture they have created. We could, you know, we have attempted to, and we could launch an entire series about talking about what the heck they do with the Klingons and how that jumps around. And it is difficult when, you know, an entire planet thinks one way, has big shoulder pads, all that kind of stuff, speaks one language. But yes, it's also worth mentioning that in addition to being classicists and terrible nerds, we are also both historians. So we're sorry. You're welcome.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Buckle up, right? That's what this show is. Well, we have been at this for a long time. Hard to say exactly how long, because we did get a little interrupted by my baby. But everything that we have talked about so far has really just been the setup for this two-part story. We don't actually have the plot of this episode yet. The plot is going to be about getting Picard to Romulus to find Spock, but it is time to get that now. So if you want to cross the neutral zone and infiltrate Romulan space without being detected, you need a cloaked ship. But the Federation doesn't have cloaking devices. Fortunately, Picard has a great relationship with the Chancellor of the Klingon Empire, who will probably definitely let him borrow a bird of prey with a cloaking device. Except that the Chancellor, Gowron, won't answer the phone because he is trying to distance himself from the Federation and the role that Picard played in his accession to the throne. But Picard gets a chance here to monologue at a junior adjutant, and this monologue gets them their ship. It's not really the ship, I guess, so much as it is tickets for a ride to Romulus, which we will get to in a moment.
I think we could sum up this entire scene as Picard trying to say, without actually saying it or betraying much emotion at all, "Do you know who I am?"
I'd like to think that Patrick Stewart sometimes uses this tone at like restaurants and stuff. Except I don't think he has to, because everyone does know who he is, and he's beloved. I guess, you know, Patrick Stewart probably not going to a lot of actual Klingon restaurants, though. I don't know. Maybe he is.
Yeah, he doesn't sell his interest in Gok as well as Riker does. He is not the man for this mission, to be quite frank. It should be Riker.
Yeah, let's talk about the Klingon ship. So this sequence is completely designed to complement what we see in Star Trek VI, which is very, very, very much about Klingons, right? We spend time on a Klingon ship, at a Klingon trial, in a Klingon prison. We hear a lot of spoken Klingon. And we get a lot of that here as well. And the Klingon captain is a jerk. Picard and Data are going to have to share a room. There are no mattresses. Yeah, the food, it's living worms, right? All of this is kind of a primer on Klingons. But yeah, it's very clear that Picard is pretending to prefer sleeping on a bed with no mattress and to enjoy gawk and so on. Whereas I actually believe that Riker's into that stuff, at least, you know, for like a month.
Yeah, Picard does not sell it. And I love when they write his flaws into his character, right? Like he's this very, very iconic figure that so many people look up to, who's so good at so many things, but TNG does an excellent job of writing in his flaws, right? Like how awkward he is around children and how really awkward he is pretending to want to sleep on this, you know, piece of metal.
Right. Well, I think going to a Klingon ship is like joining a frat temporarily. And yeah, like for Riker, that's just like, yeah, I loved college. But like, Patrick Stewart, I think maybe had a different experience of the academy than Riker did. It was a lot more academic than Riker's experience was, right? Picard's nerdiness shows off here.
Yeah, Picard at a frat party is like, I too would like to consume some beer. Right. And like that is what he brings to this scene.
Right. He actually is just going to start reciting Shakespeare lines about beer and not actually drink any.
I heard that was one of the scenes, but they cut it from the final
episode. Oh, man. I would watch an entire show. Well, yeah, we would all watch an entire show of Patrick Stewart doing Shakespeare. And we've been getting that during lockdown. He's been doing a sonnet a day, which has been a delightful thing to watch on the internet. Well, we also do get some comedy here. I mean, I guess this has been comedic as well, but we get another comedic bit here about how creepy Data is. This scene is really great. I mean, this is like the buddy cop show we never got.
I honestly don't think Data's being that creepy. I think I don't understand why Picard is being such a baby. Like he's the captain of the Enterprise. Like it's an android. Like just sleep. It's fine. He's not staring at you. Get over it.
Well, I mean, I think this is a big part of who Picard is, right? Is that I think a lot of people probably would just regard Data as a machine and not be bothered. But for Picard, Data's a person, right? So it feels a lot like Data's just creepily looming over him and also staring at him while he's sleeping. And being stared at while you're sleeping is just like that's in the top 10 creepiest things that can happen to you.
Oh, you took my argument and made it sound like I was saying Data's not a person. Ugh, that was effective and not what I meant to communicate. Touche. 10 points to Glenn. Person or not, I really just think, I don't know. I thought Picard was being a bit fussy. And maybe that's also part of Picard's characters, that he really likes to be alone in his silky pajamas with his nice bed and his old books. And he is a bit fussy, perhaps.
Right. I mean, what's really going on here is that no one's going to sleep except for Riker. No one is going to sleep on this just like metal. It's like metal wire that he's sleeping on. No way to get comfortable and settle in there. Well, let's move on here. So Picard and Data are going to have to masquerade as Romulans. And it's really cool to see Patrick Stewart and Brent Spiner in Romulan makeup, which I think is almost always the impetus to do an episode like this, right? This is really probably how this whole idea started. But before they beam down to the planet, Picard learns of Sarek's death. And now he knows that he's going to have to tell Spock that his dad is dead. And thinking about this, Picard and Data have a conversation about fathers and sons and emotional barriers, and it's pretty clear that Picard is mostly talking about his relationship with his own father here. And I think there are several layers to this, because Picard does also have this relationship with Sarek, and Picard is also kind of Data's father figure. So we're going to get some more about fathers and sons in this episode. But before our heroes beam down to Romulus, we also get a scene with Pardek. He's in the office of Proconsul Neral. We have no idea what Proconsul means here. I have some more questions about Romulan constitutional matters here.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew you would not let the word Proconsul fall from your lips. I was like, maybe he won't say it. Maybe he'll just let it go. We already talked about it.
Yeah. I did let it go. It just kept coming back to me. It's not my fault.
It's too deeply embedded in your personality.
It is. But what matters here for the plot is that Neral has received intelligence that Picard is coming to Romulus, and he thinks that they should find him when he gets here. And so he tells Senator Pardek to circulate Picard's image among the security forces. And this is, I guess, what really confuses me about the Romulan government and the chain of command. And, you know, maybe, you know, another, I don't know, sort of caveat here right before I ask my questions. I should say that world building is what I chiefly go to speculative fiction for. I am really interested in learning about strange new worlds and new civilizations and seeing how they work. What I really like to do is to do social and institutional history on these made-up civilizations. And so for me, tugging at these strings, maybe poking holes in this sort of thing, this is a huge part of the fun of engaging with sci-fi for me. So my comments, my questions like this are not really meant to be a complaint, even though perhaps some might take them that way. But what I was just wondering here in this conversation is, hey, isn't there an actual bureaucracy to do this sort of thing? Isn't Pardak a representative and not an administrator, right? Like, undersecretaries of defense don't call senators to their office and ask them to circulate people's mugshots, right? In the United States. That's not how this works.
Yes. I don't know what will satisfy you. It doesn't make any sense. I agree. And yet, here it is. Enter the world with us, Glenn. Enter.
Right. I am bought in. I just wanted to point that out. The other thing, too, of course, is about the term proconsul, and maybe that's really more our angle here. Proconsul is an office that you would get after being consul in the Roman Republic. And consul is, you know, it's like the equivalent of prime minister or president. There were two at a time. That was a very strange constitution that the Roman Republic had. And then after that, you would serve for 5 years, usually 5 years anyway, as a proconsul, which meant really that you were sent to be a governor of a territory as kind of a reward for having done the service of serving as the co-head of state for your 1 year term. But here, this seems to be someone who's, as I said, much more akin to like an undersecretary of defense or undersecretary of state or something like that. This is someone who's, I don't know, four or five, maybe at least three rungs down, I think, and is maybe more of a bureaucrat than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're learning is that, you know, the Trek writers took a lot of the language of the Romans into their conception of the Romulans. But didn't necessarily feel the need to follow that through, right? It's more to gesture at than to be the exact same as. Because you're right, if this were a proconsul in the Roman way, this would be a figure that, you know, has quite a bit of authority and power and would be very, very commanding of respect and potentially some fear.
Right. And Deep Space Nine eventually is going to settle on the idea that the Praetor is the head of state of the Romulan Star Empire, which in actual Rome, rather than space Rome, was pretty low down. I mean, it was still a high-ranking person, but low, three or four rungs down from the consul, who would have been the head of state in the Roman Republic. And then this gets really, really shown to us in Nemesis that has to take its cue from Deep Space Nine. We'll get to all of that someday, which will be a lot of fun. Or people will decide that they don't ever want to hear us talk about Romulans again because of this conversation, and we won't. But in any case, Picard and Data are now on Romulus, and they are looking for Senator Pardak at a law office that is run by one of his family members. But they've gotten there before it opens, and so they get some soup from a nearby restaurant, and they sit outside and very awkwardly slurp at it. But while this is going on, we get some depiction of Romulus as a police state, right? It's a police state where everyone is worried that no one is who they say they are, everyone is out to get them. And where the police are not protecting people, but are really just a terrorizing presence to subjugate people.
Again, I think it's worth, you know, if you want to, you know, lower the tone, lighten the tone from all of our heavy discussions that might put people off. I do want to say that seeing Patrick Stewart and even Brent Spiner in the Romulan getup made me feel some feelings that I don't know what to do with yet. I thought they looked great. And I am very into the costume design of the Romulans and also of the Vulcans. I want to get to the point in our own world where we start dressing like that. Also, I have a question, which is like, I don't understand how an entire planet dresses the same, but whatever. But the Romulans have been dressing with those pointy things for a really long time, like over 100 years, the same shoulder pad silhouette. And I find that very intriguing.
Yeah, I do too. One, I will say that I also love the Romulan aesthetic. I love all the right angles. I love the bird of prey. I love the costumes. I love the haircuts too. I love the whole thing. This is maybe part of why I want to keep stopping and just talking about Romulan stuff as we get it here. I also want to know what this soup is so I can make it at home. But yeah, I think that what we're seeing here is Romulan civilization, Romulan culture, as stagnant's probably not the right word, but as extremely conservative and unchanging. It is also, you know, we should say, because this is what the episode is going to end up being about, Romulans and Vulcans are the same species. So we talked already about how long Vulcans live. Well, Romulans live that long as well. So a century for them is like, you know, one generation of adulthood. So, you know, fashion change, art change, and so on, it's going to happen at a slower pace in a culture where people live longer, right?
But not that slow. Like, that's still, like, that is not, like, we had 10 years of shoulder pads similar to that. And, you know, like, 10 does not equal 100, right? Like, 10 human does not equal 100 Vulcan or Romulan. So, but I kind of liked your idea when you were speaking about it being, you know, a very conservative society. Something that came to mind for me was maybe this is just indicative of the militarized aspect of the state, right? That, like, there is a way you dress, that it's got a uniform quality to it that the entire planet has to do. And that is telling us something about what it's like to live there and you know, how the government or how the military or how the police function in this society, that it's very prescriptive, right? I also want to point out that, again, I think it was for comedy and it worked. I did think it was hilarious, and I love any scene that is between Patrick Stewart and Brent Spiner. Their relationship is just phenomenal. I am so drawn to it, and so is the rest of the world, and we got some of that on Picard. But it doesn't make sense in terms of the story that Picard would be so bad at, you know, being undercover, right? Like, it's so obvious he hates this soup and has never had it before. And, you know, a couple minutes ago in the show, he was accusing Data of, you know, not of being too android-like as he walked around town and, like, drawing suspicion. Whereas, like, Patrick Stewart eating soup is very suspicious.
Right. Well, you said earlier that Riker should be the one on this mission, and that is true, right? The whole deal with the Next Generation is that the captain never goes on away missions, right? That's what the first officer is for. The rules are the captain stays on the ship, and Kirk was just violating those rules, you know, every opportunity he could. And so Picard maybe doesn't have a whole lot of experience with this, or at least hasn't done this sort of thing in a long time. And so while he's a great diplomat, you know, something that we're told over and over again and do see from time to time, he's not a good spy. He's not a good spec ops, you know, operative here. But Riker's generally pretty good at this sort of thing, right? Because it's just putting on a persona, which Riker is always doing with every person he encounters, right? That's his whole shtick.
Oh. Riker. I think he really likes it. I think he's just like, he settles into situations easily and authentically and with remarkable cool chill.
I agree. You did say it more nicely than I did. I was not criticizing Riker. I mean, I have serious Riker envy. Let's be clear about that. I want to go back to something you were saying about this being a police state and the uniformity here, because this is one of the things that I think really fascinates me about how Romulus is being depicted in this episode. It is Space Rome, Space Roman Republic, but it is also a representative government. It has some kind of representative Senate here as well, but then at the same time is also a police state, right? So it's being ancient Rome in space. It's kind of being 20th century America in space, but then it is also being East Germany in space as well. And the writers are blending all three of those things together. And this is, you know, this is really the most we have ever seen of Romulan society in Trek before. I mean, that's not true now. We have seen a lot more and we kind of take that for granted. But this is really the first time that the writers are sitting down and saying, what is Romulus like? And so there is this element of the police state here. And indeed, these Romulan cops do take Data and Picard. They arrest them, I guess. And really what they do is take them to an underground lair. But they do all of this at gunpoint. But then Senator Pardek is there and he assures them that he knows who they are and that they're all friends. It feels very Bond villain for just a moment. But then Spock is also there. And this is a great, great entrance. I remember slow clapping in my heart when I watched this live back in 1991. And even now, when I know it's coming, when I know Leonard Nimoy is about to step out of the shadows, I still squeal a little bit.
I am forever grateful to Leonard Nimoy for just everything, but also the frequency with which, you know, he clearly wanted to appear in several different iterations of Trek across time, right? Like, he's just the gift that keeps on giving. and maybe that's part of the moment of the excitement when he steps out of the shadows. Though I will say, I was more into watching the two pretend police officers take off their police uniforms, and I was like really looking at the jacket and wanted it. I was also just really struck by, like, what did they do? Just like walk down a dirt path into a weird cave? Like, they don't seem to have gone very far. Like, how and where are they hiding, and what's happening? And was that just like a weird corner that Spock was standing in until people arrived, or is there a room back there? Like, I think I just have a lot of questions.
I have these same questions. Let's raise them in the next episode when we start to get more about this location. But yeah, like, how long were Picard and Data marched at gunpoint by these police officers, these fake police officers? Because the impression that we're given in the episode is that it's like they've just stepped around the corner, but they're in this like busy, bustling neighborhood in Romulus, and then all of a sudden they're in a cave complex. So yeah, questions, but we'll talk more about that. I'll talk more about that next time. Something I want to talk about with regarding Leonard Nimoy is, you know, he was really excited to do this, this two-part episode here, in big part because he wanted to do cross-promotion for Star Trek VI, which was really kind of his baby, right? The idea, the story of Star Trek VI was his idea. He had pitched it to the studio, and he was really invested in it. He was really invested in the idea of doing a Star Trek film that was very much about the end of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. And that is what we're getting here, right? This episode, or certainly the second part that we'll do next month, is going to be about other aspects of that. And so Leonard Nimoy, very invested in that. And he essentially had to do this episode for free because the Next Generation budget just couldn't afford Leonard Nimoy's normal going rate for acting. So they paid him the minimum amount allowed by the union. And so rather than get paid out of the Star Trek TNG budget, I guess he got some extra credits on the Star Trek VI film, which then led to more residual payments or something like that. But there was a lot of like sort of weird kind of like accounting that had to go on in order to get Leonard Nimoy in these episodes without violating union rules and stuff, which is itself quite interesting.
I mean, of course, I never knew Leonard Nimoy personally, sad to say, to surprise everyone with that fact. But there's something about, not only do I just love Spock, he's probably my favorite Trek character, if I'm being honest. There's just something about Leonard Nimoy that gives to me the sense that he really, really cares deeply about this universe. And maybe that kind of goes back to, you know, what the Jonathan Frakes video that I was mentioning at the top of the episode of the way in which Roddenberry wanted people to be on board with what was being built here. And I just get the sense that Leonard Nimoy embodies that. Maybe he didn't, you know, I'm sure he was a real person with flaws, all those things, but I am comforted by being able to read him that way, and it makes me happy.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Of course, he was a person who had flaws and sometimes maltreated people in his life. That's every single one of us, right? But he definitely is one of the Trek actors who became an ambassador for Roddenberry's optimistic worldview, which is not true of every Star Trek actor, right? But Leonard Nimoy was very invested in this vision of the future and was a great ambassador for it. And, you know, we did start this episode off by saying thank you to the creators here. And we should say thank you to Leonard Nimoy as well for not just all the joy that he gave us by being Spock on screen, but for all the good that he tried to do in the world with his fame as well.
Yeah. And this, you know, less of a presence in so much of the Star Trek canon, but, you know, similar figures here that immediately come to mind are Nichelle Nichols and George Takei.
Yeah, absolutely. And hey, we'll get some TOS soon, and we'll get to talk about them again eventually. So this revelation that Spock is for some reason standing in the corner in this cave. This is the end of the episode, but what we have not done here ourselves yet is the B plot. So let's do that, then we'll be able to call it a day.
Oh my gosh, I forgot there was a B plot.
Yes, well, maybe
we...
I was
so invested.
Maybe we all did. That is actually why I structured it this way, because I did not want to be interrupting all of that with the B plot, though it is actually, I think, done well in the episode to pace it out that way, to tease some of these things to us and then take them away while we have to deal with, like, you know, some CSI story here. So what is going on here is that Geordi has identified the wreckage of this spaceship as the deflector array from the Vulcan ship T'Pau. That is the woman who oversaw the fight in the TOS episode, Amok Time. So that's a great connection there. The ship is supposed to be decommissioned and it's supposed to be hanging out at a space depot. But obviously something is not right about that story. So while Picard and Data take the Klingon Express to Romulus, Riker is going to take the Enterprise to do an inventory check at the depot, which does not sound that exciting, but actually there's a lot going on here. So Klim Dokachin manages the depot, and he really does not want to talk with Riker, or anyone, I think. And he tells Riker to contact the scheduling department to make an appointment. But Riker will not just make an appointment. I wonder what this tells us about Federation bureaucracy, or I don't know. I suppose it's probably telling us more about Riker than anything else. But instead of just like making an appointment, he makes Troy spend time with Dokachin so that he will help them. And Troy looks totally deflated when she realizes that she's going to have to do this. And I think at this point in the run of Next Generation, we are just in this phase where this is kind of what Deanna Troi is for. And I don't love it.
There's a lot of ways that TNG did a disservice to Marina Sirtis and Troy's character in not letting it fully develop, really, into something that could have been so wonderful, especially the very unique role of ship's counselor, which we just like don't really see elsewhere in the Trek universe, and I think was such a novel and delightful and necessary invention on TNG. Also probably worth saying to first-time listeners that while I used to be a classicist and historian, I am now a therapist and social worker. So that explains a lot of that. We are a hard thread to follow, Glenn, aren't we?
We sure are. And hey, someday we're going to get to do the episode where Deanna Troi dresses up as a Romulan. And I don't know, that will be like the best of everything. It'll be like reaching the nexus, right? I think the universe, or at least our universe, will just implode on itself whenever we do that episode.
Which it does all the time, and that's why we keep coming back to Trek. But you know, in the episode here, when Riker first says, like, because Troy, I think, is actually playing a useful function in the moment where they're trying to get this guy to help them out and he won't, and Troy steps in and is like, let me tell you about the personality structure and ego of this person so that we can use that information to get him to help us. Like, we're gonna have to play his game. Here's his point of view. Here's what his life is like. Let's consider that as we interact with him. And that's actually a really rich and useful addition, right, to the mission. And when Riker says, great, let's use you to help us with that, I genuinely in that moment thought, let's use your actual intellectual and empathic skill set to help us here. And so my heart kind of broke. I was pretty grossly disappointed. And I mean grossly in terms of both icky and large, disappointed to see that it was actually just that she was pretty and he would talk to her. And it didn't even make sense to me how we got from one to the other, to be quite frank.
Well, we are very near the end here. So there are two ships missing from the depot. It turns out that one of these ships is a sort of storage facility that gets spare parts and supplies beamed onto it. And what is happening is that a well-armed, very serious business, but totally unidentifiable ship has been showing up at the scheduled beaming times and helping themselves to all of this stuff. And so the Enterprise is going to investigate here. There's a confrontation, and the Enterprise accidentally blows up the other ship, meaning that now there is not anyone to interrogate about what is going on. So good job, Riker. But we're going to have to wait until next month to figure out if and how these two plots, the A plot and the B plot here, are going to collide. Spoiler, they are.
Who would have thunk it? Who would have thunk it? Yeah, I was really struck here by the murder. I don't know how else to put it. Like, the Enterprise just blew up some people.
Yeah, and it is accidental. It's not the intention, right? And you know, Geordi sees what's going on, and they do try to stop the explosion, but it's just not possible. But yeah, it's really surprising, and I think this is looking ahead to the next episode when they have to pick up this investigation again. The way that Riker feels about what happened here when he is talking about it with other people seems way more callous than I would expect. This just seems like the sort of thing that sometimes happens in a day's work on the Enterprise, and not the attitude of, we hold all life to be treasured and sacred.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think you get a little bit of that even in the scene that is in part one, this episode here, right? Where I don't see Riker's like heart break, right? Or face indicate that like, oh my gosh, what have we done? Which we see Riker do it at other points, right? And it's a big feature of TNG that they care about this kind of stuff really deeply. And, you know, it's a feature of most Trek as well. So I was already struck by the coldness, even though you're right, it was not intentional. But the impact, right, was that they blew up an entire ship of people that they did not intend to kill. And I was just longing for a bigger reaction to that, even here in part one.
Yeah, a little more remorse would have been nice. I think we could have spared 30 seconds for a kind of like negative reaction shot from Riker that isn't just about like, we're not going to be able to interrogate these people, but is that, you know, I killed people, right? People have actually died here. You know, even just doing something like, let's send out a rescue shuttle anyway, just to see if there are any survivors, even just a line saying, let's do that, would have, I think, done a lot to mollify that. But we will have to pick this thread up next time. This now really is the end of Unification Part 1. And so it is the end of our episode as well. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland. And as always, for longtime listeners, and here's some new information for you if you're new to us, you can find us and all of the other podcasts under our umbrella at claytemplemedia.com.
We would love for you to come talk to us about the first part of this two-parter here. We have a forum there on claytemplemedia.com where you can do that. And there is also a Clay Temple Media subreddit if you are someone who is active on Reddit. A lot of things we talked about here. Maybe come speculate with us about Romulan government. Maybe you actually have some better answers about the impetus for the Federation-Cardassian War. We would love to hear about that. We'd love to talk with you about that. So we will be back on October 15th with part two, with Unification Part 2.
And until then, stay spacey.